Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Billboard on Broadway podcast. I'm your host, Rebecca Milzoff, deputy features editor at Billboard and Broadway expert here. So have you guys heard of this thing called rent? That is pretty much a punchline in musical theater circles at this point, because it's impossible to talk about new musicals today, particularly any that have a rock or pop sound, without referencing the show written by Jonathan Larson that debuted on Broadway in 1996 and became one of the longest running and most beloved Broadway shows ever. I feel a little silly even trying to explain Rent and the phenomenon that it was and continues to be for so many new generations of musical theater lovers. So if you're not familiar with it, I would just say get yourself to the interwebs, download the original Broadway cast recording, listen to it all the way through. Your life will totally be changed. It's also hard to talk about Rent and its impact without talking about Jonathan Larson himself, which is always very bittersweet. Larson and his music were really the template for what the modern, young, boundary-breaking Broadway composer looks like now. We would not have a Lin-Manuel Miranda or a Pasek and Paul or a Joe Iconis without him. But he never got to see the extraordinary thing that Rent became, because he died suddenly the night before the show's off-Broadway previews began. Though he's most famous for writing Rent, and in fact he won Tonys and the Pulitzer Prize after his death for it, Larson was very prolific otherwise in his short time here. He wrote other shows, most notably one called Tick, Tick, Boom, and also the unproduced musical Superbia in 1984. A group of today's young musical theater stars, along with a few special guests, including some original Rent cast members, are determined for more people to hear Larson's music beyond Rent, which I think is great. So they created something called the Jonathan Larson Project and came to the podcast to talk about it. Here is my chat with George Salazar, who you Be More Chill fans know as Michael from the show, Krista Rodriguez and Andy Mientis, who you might know from the cast of Spring Awakening, among many other shows that they've done, and Daphne Rubin-Vega, who really needs little introduction. She came to the podcast recently for the show Miss You Like Hell, and she is, well, an icon to any Rent lover.
Cages or wings, which do you prefer? Ask the birds. Fear or love, baby, don't say the answer. Actions speak louder than words.
Yeah, my name is George Salazar. I'm 5'10 and half Filipino and half Ecuadorian.
Mm-hmm. And wearing a really great shirt.
Thanks. It's very old.
I'm Daphne Rubin-Vega. I'm a Scorpio with a Taurus rising, I think. Ooh. I don't know. Maybe that's just a myth. What else? I was the original Mimi in Rent, and that's why I'm here.
Oh, my God. I didn't even know.
I know.
Kidding.
Hi. I'm Andy Mientis. I'm a double Scorpio. Scorpio sun, Scorpio rising, Pisces moon. Happy birthday. Do you have a birthday coming up?
Yes.
You must. Yes,
happy
me
birthday,
too, girl.
Me
happy
too.
Birthday. And I'm going to be really mortified to talk about how much I love Rent in front of Daphne Rumenega. So here we all are.
My name is Krista Rodriguez. I am a Leo. And Andy reads my charts for me and gives me all the good and bad news. So that's all how I know about my stuff. And I'm excited to be here. That's all I got.
Well, I'm a Taurus and I know nothing about astrology. So will we get along well since
yes,
you're a Taurus
we
rising?
We all get along.
Excellent. We can all be friends.
Yes.
Well, so first of all, I want to know, what is the Jonathan Larson Project in the first place?
So Jennifer Ashley Tepper, theater historian, producer, she does everything. She spent a lot of time in the Larson archives over in Washington, D.C., combing through scribblings and demo recordings. And so she's unearthed close to 30 songs written by Jonathan Larson that have, for the most part, never been heard. And we are so excited to be bringing so much of his music to the forefront and at 54 Below in a week. Yeah. And so there's 8 days. Yeah. And so there's a, you know, there's there are
125,000.
Yes, there are. There are 5 cast members in the show and then a rotating roster of incredible guest artists such as Daphne Rubin-Vega, who will be joining us and singing some, you know, additional things. So everyone who comes to each show is going to get a different experience. It's kind of exciting.
Yeah. So why was there a reason that now felt like the right moment to be doing this and to kind of be introducing the world to these songs of Jonathan's that are lesser known?
I can say that it does feel like a time to have a social uprising in the arts community. And I think that's what Rent did for its generation when it came out. And we haven't really had our sort of moment with art in that way necessarily. There's been a lot of things said, but as far as something that rallies up a younger group to pay attention. And what I've been struck with the most about working on this music is how relevant it is today, how specific things that he was writing about are still specifically a problem now, or things that we are now marching for, and maybe things that were marginalized even in 92 that now in this day and age are on the forefront. And I think to be able to acknowledge that that was happening then and is still happening now gives us some sort of power moving forward. And so I'm actually really excited to share this music with a generation that now has so much information in front of them and can maybe use it in the right way.
It makes sense to me. So how, I know the answer for you, Daphne, although you can still tell us stories about it, but how was each of you introduced to Jonathan's music in the first place in your musical lives?
Well, I'll go first. I was taken to the first national tour of Rent when I was probably a little bit too young to see Rent by most people's estimation. But for some reason, my mother, because moms know everything, thought that it was something that I needed to see. She'd probably read about it in, like, Time and was like, yeah, that. And so I went and I sat in the balcony. And growing up, I loved theater and I loved musicals, but...
Where were you?
I was in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And so I was raised, though, with a lot of, like, classic rock and folk and... R&B and music. You know, no one in my house was a theater person. They were music people. So while I would go and like see little shows at like the high school and stuff, I was like, oh, that's cute. But it didn't really connect with the things that I loved about music at the time. And just nothing really like hit me in the soul the way that I needed to then like decide I wanted to like be an actor, be in theater for a living. But Rent was the thing. It was like this, you know, this one piece that gathered so many things that I loved, and it showed me communities on stage that, like, I didn't know that I needed to see. I wouldn't know for, like, another 10 years that I needed to see them, but it was my first introduction to sort of all of the queerness that I needed, the non-binary, like, everything that I would grow up to really value was, like, all there in front of me at, like, probably 11 or 12. I was, like, just hit in the face with this thing. So then I became completely obsessed, cast album, like, Rent Bible, and my extended family was in New York. So anytime I would come to New York, I would see Rent and one other show. So I saw Rent probably, like, 30 times over the years.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Crazy. That's a lot of Rent to absorb.
I had maybe the opposite in some ways experience, because it was a little bit... I grew up in a conservative area, and it was a little more taboo where I grew up. It wasn't something, it was something that you got to experience if you proved yourself to be adult enough to experience it, I guess, in some way. But it was, like, rampant through my children's theater. It was like that album was just, like, getting passed around like wildfire, and everyone was singing the songs. And of course, like, I think I was 13 when I really became aware of it. And of course, like, you know, Seasons of Love was every graduation song. It was every cast party, tearful sing-along. It was, you know, it was like the anthem of every theater person. But I didn't see it in New York until quite a few years later when I moved to New York for school. And we won the lotto and got to see it. I sat in the front row. And, yeah, and that was the first time getting to experience it. But yeah, it was definitely like, I can't believe what they're saying. I never, you know, musicals are like happy and tap dancing and everyone's nice and says nice things to each other. So it was like my first introduction to actually trying to say something, interesting with a musical.
I got started in theater like super late. It was at the end of my time in high school, and everyone was talking about Rent. And, like, I'm so ashamed of this now. I, like, fully admit it. But I was, like, trying to, I think, like fight the trend. And so I was like, I'm not a big Rent fan at all. Like, I don't like Rent. And then as I got into college, like, obviously studying theater, like, I was like, okay, this is really good. And so I fell madly in love with it in college. And then my relationship with Jonathan, like, deepened on a really, like, really personal, intense way when I was doing Tick, Tick, Boom, this most recent revival off-Broadway. And, you know, I was so familiar with Rent, with that work of art. And I then, through my research of Jonathan and meeting his closest friends, I, like, got to know him as a person and as an artist, and I was just so, like, it was like, he's like all of us, you know, like, there was this drive and this passion, and also this, like, loyalty to his friends and this, like, family thing that, like, we all have. And so it was getting to know him in, like, a very personal way like that. It's like an honor that I get to be a part of this project.
Daphne, when you met Jonathan, were you aware of his other work, or was the first music of his that you heard music from Rent?
Music from Rent was, I think, the first stuff that I heard. And then I heard, you know, stuff from Floyd Collins and J.B. Morgan Saves the World. He was doing other musicals before Rent. So, and then he was writing songs, like, there's always that selfish part of me that wanted to write songs with him. You mm-hmm. know, I'd sung in a girl group, so, you know, it's interesting hearing all of our different experiences with musical theater. You know, I always say, like, you know, musical theater wasn't my thing. It was more music. but the musical theater that did attract me was stuff like, you know, Jesus Christ Superstar or Hair or Tommy. I remember hearing not the musical Tommy, but The Who's Tommy, to me, that was like a rock opera. And that was a story being told, and they were very dark. And, you know, when you're so young, you don't realize how, quote, unquote, dark something is. It just seems like drama. So I don't know what I'm saying. I'm saying that I wanted to write music with Jonathan. There was a lot of other stuff. But Rent was like the thing that I was very aware that, like, I didn't really love musical theater, but I loved what that was. And it spoke to me and, like, quote, unquote, my tribe. Do you know? It really defined what a tribe was for me, that it didn't have to do with what you looked like. It was like who you are in your soul. And that it really attracted, you know, now with the internet and, you know, social media, we can find our tribe. We don't have to fly there or walk there or take a train. So this did that for me. And so I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, yeah. No, I was going to say that I feel like I should share my own personal introduction to Jonathan's story, too, which is that, you know, I was in my high school drama club and I did love kind of classic musical theater. And I just remember that, like, the cool girls in the drama club were always going, "Hey, mister, she's my sister," to each other. And I was like, what are they talking about? Like, this is some kind of inside joke. So I finally figured out that it was from Rent. And I don't remember how I very quickly became a fan, but I'm from Connecticut, outside Hartford, and the Hartford Current used to have kind of a back page of its art section that was all written by high school students, and it was like reviews of CDs, which existed back then. And I knew that Rent was coming to Hartford to play the Bushnell, the big theater there, and I, like any Rent fan worth their salt, I decided that I was the only person who was capable of writing about Rent and that nobody else could do it. So I remember writing to the editor and saying, like, Rent is coming and you need to cover it, and I'm the only person who can write about it. And in a very strange full circle moment, I think that's like the first writing assignment that I like really had, like a real professional writing assignment.
I love that.
So yeah, so my life really began with Rent in terms of the journalistic world, at least.
See, I feel like I need to say this in, on behalf of having known Jonathan, that I'm in complete denial about how old I am. You know? And like,
me too.
You know, and I, you know, you get to a point where you like lie and you tell the truth, you lie, you're proud of it. But like the awareness of the fact that, you know, you were born in 1982. You know, that was like really, you know, you're my niece's age. Like, I could have arguably given birth to you. You know what I mean? Like, in, you know, Juliet, you know, like, you know, anyway, that's not the point. The point is,
let's just
totally digress. No, just hearing okay, I was talking about Jonathan and to like represent that he never got to experience how he impacted the world. Like the world, you know, he was a dude who wore Converse high tops that were really stinky, and there was a Gumby on his, you know, dashboard, like on his rusty car that needed gas. Do you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That, like, he never got to eat at Sardi's, like, and we, you know, everybody here is like, Sardi's, but, you know, fuck Sardi's, you know? but he never had the chance to see how he impacted the world so palpably, so viscerally. And I get to do that. I remember that was part of like the huge mourning process, that like when we cried and we didn't know what we were crying about, you know, that was what it was. It was like, so as effed up as that feels, like that's like the most beautiful thing that he has done. He has changed people's lives, like in very, very palpable ways. And I knew it, you know, but like I didn't know anything, you know, I didn't know anything. So anyway, you know, and his parents are still around, and his sister, of course, his mm-hmm. nephews, that like have that blood DNA. But, you know, more than that, like we have like the real Jonathan Gene, mm-hmm. you yeah. know, like anyone who wins a grant, anyone who like heard the word, no matter where they come from, who they, you know, what color, what their favorite color is, doesn't matter. It's nice.
Well, I've always wondered what, you know, you and the other cast members who are still around, you're like his living legacy, basically. And that's not necessarily what you sign on for when you do a musical. And I, as much as you love him and as much as this is I assume, kind of a good part of your life, that has to be have been an interesting thing to absorb and kind of deal with as the years have gone by.
Yeah, it's like cicadas. You know, like you have to go underground and just like stop. You know, I thought I'm never ever going to sing that song again or do that song. Like, okay, I'll show up, but not this way or under conditions or like just no. I used to call it like the mob, you know, they just keep crawling back. But
I like the cicadas idea.
It is like
emerge every so often. Mm.
You know, it's like we talk so much about privilege these days and what's a privilege. Like, this is our privilege. And sometimes, mm-hmm. you know, your privilege is like it weighs on you like too fucking bad, mm-hmm. you know?
This is true.
Just do it. Yeah.
So I feel like we've kind of touched on a bunch of things as you've talked about how you discovered Jonathan's music. But it's hard for me to put a finger on what it is about it precisely that just makes it something that connects with young people so much and continues to over 20 years later after Rent. And, you know, some of it is, I think, as you said, Andy, that it like made you realize that rock and pop could be a part of musical theater in a natural way. And some of it is just what you connect with and the message. And I think, too, it's just the lyrics like, "Hey, mister, she's my sister," that are easy to memorize and keep in your head. But for each of you, I mean, what is the hook into Jonathan's music for you that makes it so special?
I probably would piggyback on what Krista said. Like, it really feels like he wrote like protest anthems. Mm-hmm. And there are quite a few of those in the Jonathan Larson project. And the specifically, like, I'll never forget, we were doing Tick, Tick, Boom. It was the day after the election in 2016. Mm. It was 11/9. And we were all in really terrible moods. And we did not want to come to work that day. And the audience felt really down and sad as well. And just the overall vibe in the theater was kind of somber. And we got to the end of the show and we sang Louder Than Words. It hit us like a ton of bricks, like the words that we were singing and the meaning they had on that day. And we, you know, finished the show and met some audience members, and they were all like, "I didn't know I really needed to see this today." You know, all mm-hmm. these years later, his work is like providing like comfort and also charging people up. Like it is so effective in so many ways.
This is making me wonder, like, why there hasn't been another Jonathan Larson show on Broadway besides Rent. I mean, it seems like we could maybe use one. Just a thought.
Yeah. I mean, sadly, there's very few of them that we're lucky to have. Mm-hmm. I mean, Tick, Tick, Boom had like an amazing run off Broadway and has a great album. And then there's Superbia out there, which is in some stage of completion, from what I understand. But for some reason, we've never gotten to see it. But I think Jennifer Tepper, I'm talking about, her hope with this collection of songs is that maybe this can become a new sort of new Jonathan Larson show, like a song cycle that he never got to put together that, you know, she's taken up the mantle and put together for him. So maybe we have another one now, which would be really incredible.
Yeah. I realize I don't know, have the three of you ever been in a Rent production or been able to sing anything Rent related?
I did a production of Rent in Salt Lake City. It was right after the like regional rights had become available. So I felt very lucky. It was like right at the beginning of people being allowed to do Rent. Karen Eisenberg was the director who knew Jonathan and had gone to his peasant feasts. And she, on the first day of rehearsal, so already I'm freaking out, right? Because it's my dream role. I'm in Salt Lake City, which is gorgeous. And so I'm nervous, weirdly, because I just like have imagined what I would do with this part since like I can remember. And
which part were you playing?
I was Mark.
Okay.
I was Mark. And she gathered us all around and told us a story about how she had gone to one of Jonathan's famous peasant feasts, which were these dinners that he would have, these sort of potluck dinners for his broke friends, broke artist friends. And she had been there, and he had said, "Hey, Karen, I have this script. Would you take a look at it? Like, I just want to get some like eyes on it and know what people think." And so he gave her a script in an envelope, and at this point, she pulls out the envelope with his handwriting on it. Wow. And a cassette, and she like pulls out the cassette, and on the front in his handwriting, it says Rent. And she made this available for us to read in the room, and it's a very early draft. It opens with Santa Fe, I believe. They're like around like a trash can on fire, like a, you know, like a fire outside. And the cassette is all him singing with like a MIDI keyboard, and I burst into tears, and that was like the best way ever to start a production, and it was like one of my favorite things I've ever done.
That's pretty amazing. I was gonna say, and then did everyone start weeping at the same time?
Yes, naturally.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for, but you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
What about for the two of you?
I've not been fortunate enough to do Rent, unfortunately. I would love to. Someone, anybody.
Yeah. I feel like maybe that ship has sailed for me. But I did audition to be the swing in the Broadway production.
You're kidding.
Yeah. When I first came to New York, they were, you know, it was like, it's one of those shows like Spring Awakening was too, where it's like, we need young, we need new, we need, before YouTube, where you could be like, who's the cool singer-songwriter? People were scouring, and Telsey was looking everywhere for every age and auditions on the weekends and stuff. It was like, we have to keep this show full of energy and newness and youth and, you know. So, yeah, and I auditioned to play Maureen Mimi cover, probably like one of the stripper dragsters, you know, something like that. But no, I didn't get it. I remember I messed up one of the lyrics.
No.
And I was like, how could I mess up?
What lyric was it? Which one?
It was in Take Me or Leave Me. It was, if I could remember right now, I would remember. Anyway, I've never played anything Jonathan Larson. This is my first time singing any Jonathan Larson songs.
So for the Jonathan Larson project, I would love to hear a little bit about maybe one song each of you is singing and a little bit about it that people who have also never heard anything other than Rent might be interested to know.
Well, I think Jen kind of put it in a way, she told me this on my first rehearsal, was like, we each have a character. We each have a track of songs that sort of speak to one aspect of what he was writing about. So some people have like the broke writer track. Some people have this social justice track. Some people have, you know, more musical theater stuff. I have his pop songs. So I have some of the most deliciously 90s pop songs you've ever heard. Yeah, I'm pretty excited. So my stuff is all like, it's either kind of like the pop, rock, a little bit spoken word. I have a rap. I have a social justice rap.
What?
And I have, I know, and I have a, like a big old power ballad called Love Heals, which is about, like, you know, and he wrote for, I believe it was an AIDS charity benefit, like, night. So it's one of those rousing, like, you know, big numbers. So, yeah, it's a very, it's stuff that I've never heard of his. It's less narrative and more, you know, hooks, lots of hooks and lots of, so it's been interesting to learn all that.
I have like the grunge track, I would say, like the kind of like rocky, down and dirty grunge track. And one of the songs I have that I'm really psyched about is this song called Valentine's Day. Do you know this song?
Yes, I do.
It was in Rent very briefly, apparently, at some stage of development.
Beat me till I'm black and blue and gray.
Uh-huh, that's the one. And he wrote it for a review at his college called Prostate of the Union, which was about the struggle. I swear to God, that's true. That's real. About the struggles of living in like Reagan's New York. And the character described in this song is sort of like a proto Mimi. It's like a girl who, you know, gets swept off the street by a charming guy and then enters into this abusive relationship and then winds up, you know, that she can't accept like real love. So it's really sad. But what I love about it is that it does what musical theater ought to do really well, and that I think Jonathan Larson really understood, which, going back to your earlier question about like why young people connect with it, I think it's this, that like in the golden age of musicals, you were seduced by a melody, a hook that was indistinguishable from what you might hear on the radio. Like Some Enchanted Evening was playing at the theater, you'd go home, it was playing on the radio. So you'd be seduced into listening to this story, and then you'd get like a real story. Like South Pacific is about some really political things. And so while the story of this song is like incredibly sad and incredibly evocative of a time and a place, the hook is like sick without being too flip about it. But it's like a great, if you just kind of tune your ear out and are just like listening to the song, it just sounds like this great, like sort of grungy 80s pop song. But then like the lyrics are devastating and like he's so good at that. So I love it.
Very cool. What will you be singing,
Jeffy? I don't have a track. I might be singing to a track. I'm not singing to a track. I'm singing a song that makes me think of Tears for Fears. I think it's a song that clearly no one's ever sung before. Not clearly, but supposedly. And it reminds me of, you know, part of his social activism was his just open-heartedness, his soft-bellied love of love. Just a sort of innocent, shameless song about love, you know? And it's really sweet because, yeah, it makes me think of like how John Lennon could, it's kind of like, it makes me think about John Lennon and his Imagine album. Actually, it makes me think of Tears for Fears in style, but it's sort of a surprise. It's an early, early song that he wrote. And you know how they say when you don't know how to write, just write about yourself and what you know? So it feels very open, basic. I love it.
I can't wait to hear you do it. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. My track is like environmental activist track. My favorite.
This is all very specific.
It's really, it's like really thrilling. And my favorite one that I get to do is a song he wrote called Iron Mike. And it's a song about the Exxon Valdez oil spill. So it's like,
whoa.
Yeah. And so, and it's, what I love about it is it's like, it has this very calm melody. And the music is it's really soft and like it feels like a lullaby, but the juxtaposition of like the lyrics of it is like, you know, it starts off with like the captain of the ship like falling asleep, and then as the song progresses, you know, as you get to the end, there's just like really stark imagery of like like the aquatic life, just like, you know, suffocating on oil and the denial of what had happened and the cover up and the like the market left on the environment. And so it's again, like it feels like a bit of a protest anthem, like in this really like disarming way. It's like, yeah.
Protest anthem about an oil spill that's also a lullaby is wow. Sounds like truly, kind of amazing. I mean, it's like it's incredible to hear about the sort of like wide swath of just stuff that he was encompassing in his music, and just makes you think kind of how much more he could have done. Mm-hmm. It sounds like he could have been a crazy prolific composer. Were you all involved in getting to kind of pick these songs, or was part of the direction of the show to say you're the environmental protest man?
Yes. They were given to us.
They were given to us.
Yeah, I mean, Jen. I feel like Jen narrowed it down from like probably what was a list of 100 songs, and then in the interest of time, like narrowed it down to what we have today, and then you know she very smartly was trying to. Create a through line for each of us so that there was a journey that the audience can track with each of us. But yeah, I remember when this was like, when she initially like booked the date, I was like sitting in her apartment with her and she was like, do you want to listen to some of the Jonathan Larson stuff? And she, like literally the day before she was in DC, like spending hours locked away listening to stuff. And what she found is gorgeous.
Has hearing any of these songs been very surprising to you? Or, I mean, especially to you, Daphne, having known his music for so long, or hearing all of it, does it make you think, oh, yeah, this is stuff I knew he had all along, just hearing what I knew of his music already?
What you said before about it just makes you think about how prolific he would be. You know, that's kind of what I think when I hear the recordings of him singing these songs, you know, 20 plus years ago. I think, wow, my stomach is responding.
Whoa, that was amazing.
That's
a
Jonathan.
Tiny person and a loud stomach.
I swallowed a piece of him.
You have some Jonathan in your stomach.
Yes,
what
Jonathan
did I do?
Is acting. It's Halloween.
I was really surprised by one of my songs has this really like, I'm going to say, but I'm going to qualify it in a second, but I'm going to say almost cliche sounding arpeggiation in the piano. I say this because it's, when it starts, it sounds like that musical theater, that contemporary musical theater ballad. And I was like, oh, wow, he was doing that thing that like so many young composers do of like that arpeggiation and the melody. And then you realize this song was written in 1982 and that contemporary musical theater arpeggiation didn't exist. Like he invented it. He was the pioneer. It wasn't cliche at all. It was actually like really groundbreaking stuff, and you know, and then his voice as a writer informed all those writers that do that thing now.
Yeah.
So like, you're gonna hear this one song start, and you're gonna say like, "Oh, I've sort of heard a ballad like this before," but it's one of the earliest songs we have in the show. It was written in 1982, so it's just like amazing what he was tapped into without even knowing it, and it just makes me think about like, of course, he would have been prolific. That's evidenced by like how much material we still have. We're still discovering in the short time that he was alive. But it makes me think about what the content of that material that doesn't exist might be. Like, what would he be writing? What would it sound like? What technologies would he be using in musical theater that we can't even conceive of? What sounds? What, you know, what would he be having that piano line do? It's really amazing.
Yeah, I was going to say, now everybody else is copying him, and that's why it sounds like that.
There's a song called Green Street that we do, and in the demo recording, like towards the end, he kind of trails off and talks about like how he loves to laugh, and he's just like, he's genuinely like belly laughing in this recording. And I, you know, there he had written so many like really powerful songs that kind of encapture the struggle of an artist or humans or people who are underrepresented. And it was like very nice to hear a recording of him just having like a great time and loving life. And it was something that I, you know, we've all heard stories, and you spoke of his love of love. But it was like really, it was like very nice and heartwarming to hear this one moment. So Nick Blamire gets to kind of, what's interesting is a couple of these songs are just being like kind of notated from demo recordings. So like, you know, I'm sure there's not a lyric sheet where he talks about his love of laughing. That was just something off the cuff, and it's made it into our show. So that was a very pleasant surprise in kind of unlocking some of these songs.
I feel like with someone like Jonathan, who's known for this like masterwork, it could be tempting to think of him as like the serious young man. Mm-hmm. And from everything mm-hmm. I've heard about him, that really was not the case. Yeah. It sounds like he was a delight
yeah.
of a human being. Well, part of the reason I was excited to have you four here in particular is I think that you have all been in some of the most exciting new musicals of the past decade or so, probably more than a decade because I have no concept of time anymore. and I was curious to hear, you know, maybe not exactly in musical style, but are there ways in which you see Jonathan's influence in the shows that you've done, or see ways that he kind of gave composers permission to do certain things that maybe they wouldn't have before he came along?
Absolutely. Not that I was in a whole ton of musicals before Rent at all, but from my experience, just the quote-unquote non-linearness, I remember it was a big quandary whether, you know, the first act was one day and the second act was one year, and that, how does that work, and that doesn't work, and it shouldn't. How do you go from this place to that place and just jump cut? And and I think now those aren't really big issues mm-hmm. because we just go with it, and I really think that Jonathan had a lot to do with that. Also, like mixing styles in a show mm-hmm. so that you can go from... That's been my experience, specifically.
Mm-hmm. And that was a big thing in the show you were just in, Miss You Like Hell,
yeah.
which was fantastic.
Yeah.
Really stylistically cornucopia, sort of.
Mm-hmm. I think, I mean, I've spoken a bit already about like the ways I think that he's influenced writers, but I think that the success of Rent really influenced producers into thinking about what kinds of shows can be successful, what kinds of shows people want to see, what shows can talk about. You know, were we addressing issues like that on Broadway for, you know, decades, like before? Not really. Like, but it just goes to show that any show in any genre, if it has something to say and says it well, it can find an audience and be successful. I'm sure people thought that they were mad, like thinking to take it to Broadway. I'm sure there were these conversations when it was going to move, like, oh, that'll run a little while and then the fad will wear off. And, you know, that obviously has not happened. And I think that it changed the landscape of Broadway, not just in the writing, but in the actual producing, like what gets made and what kinds of projects producers look out for, which I feel really grateful for, to like be in the post-Rent generation. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, not only the work that I've gotten to be a part of, but the work that I've gotten to see I can't imagine like what it would have been like. You know, you look at, not to throw too much shade, but you look at the shows that were going on beforehand and what was a hit back then. Mm-hmm. Really not my taste, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people love shows like that, but I'm glad that there's room for both now.
Totally.
And it speaks to a lot of the political climate that was around between Hair and Rent, and the things, the tastes that were coming up in who was in charge in the Reagan era of sort of wholesomeness, and to be able to kind of bust through that with something and people to embrace it, I think was really, like Andy was saying, really indicative of like what people were yearning for, the reality of this thing that was going on that no one was talking about. And musicals, the point of them is to heighten, is that you can't speak anymore, so you sing. And it's like, mm-hmm. we aren't able to talk, let's yell, let's sing, mm-hmm. let's be loud, and let's make noise. And I think that was a big triumph for that, and for shows following, that, you know, that you could stomp your feet a little bit, and people would listen. And what I was sort of piggybacking on that, that like, I think another big impact that Rent had was that Jonathan Larson was so young, listening, taking a risk on a young new composer who was doing new things. You know, I don't think that we have sort of the Lin-Manuels of the world or the young kind of the Pacek and Pauls if it's not like people, producers, putting their trust in people that say, I have a vision, just stick with me and we're going to get there. So I always admired that you can have something to say at a young age and people will listen.
That's a really good point.
Yeah. You like really redefine the formula and like, and as a result was this trailblazer that, changed the game. And like, I see so much of him in every musical theater writer, mm-hmm. Today, going back to what you were saying about the cliche musical theater writing, like it's like he's
become the cliche. Yeah.
Well, no, they've become he created and they've become the cliche. But like, but he no, he has like, you know, I as a mixed race musical theater actor, you know, when I was growing up in Florida. When I was in college in Florida, like there weren't performance opportunities for me. Like everyone was doing Oklahoma and Hello Dolly, and I would stick out like a sore thumb. So I never got summer jobs ever. And I moved to New York, and I really truly owe so much gratitude to him and to Rent, because without that, I just don't think that performers like myself would have the opportunities that they have. Where we're telling stories about people's lives, and that includes all people. He's changed the game. He changed the game so much. It's a different world that we function in, and a different art form, and he changed it for the better.
That's such a good point, because I think that I feel like one of the real triumphs of Rent is that it is a incredibly diverse cast that mm-hmm. looks the way the world looks, mm-hmm. and yet it's beside the point. It's not the first thing you think of when you're watching. It's like only afterwards you're like, oh, wow, this is fantastic.
Well, you know, you're not aware of the fact that it's a musical theater piece about all marginalized people. Mm-hmm. They are all marginalized. And like, if you say, hey, you know, I have this idea, let's like put all our money into this like new idea, let's like break, let's think of, about marginalized people. the pen, the check, they go away. The pen and the check go away.
Yeah, he even talks about privilege in Rent, like, subtly. Like, I'm thinking about...
And not so subtly.
Not so subtly, but I'm thinking about the moment when Mark is saying, like, perhaps it's because I'm the one of us to survive, and Roger says, poor baby. Like, this the one, like, straight white guy who's going to get out of this unscathed is saying, like, poor me somehow. And
But he's the witness.
Amazing. Yeah.
Do you know?
Yeah.
He becomes the witness and but the one really, who tells the story.
Yeah. Like, everyone is there. Yeah. All these conversations that we're having now.
I think
he was having... first in theater, as far as I know.
Ugh. I'm gonna cry. I mean, the performances haven't even started yet, but I feel like hopefully this will have a life beyond the shows that you're doing at 54 Below. Do you guys see there being a future for this, or ways that it could, you know, possibly evolve and keep going?
Certainly, yeah. I mean, Jen Tepper's she's a little genius. She's got some tricks up her sleeve, I'm sure, but. Yeah, I listening to these guys sing the music, it's going to be like such a great show and such a wonderful celebration of Jonathan's like work and legacy, and I don't think that post October 15th, it'll be the last of the Jonathan Larson project.
I hope not, but I'm really excited to see it. And thanks for stopping by the Tiny Billboard Library today.
Thanks for having us.
To being an us for once instead of a them. La Vie Boheme.
The Jonathan Larson Project will be going on October 9th through 14th at 54 Below. I would highly recommend checking into the 54 Below website because some of those days have more than one show per day. There are different special guests on different days. So there's a lot to check into there. And 54 is a fantastic kind of cabaret venue in New York. If you're a fan of the podcast, as always, please subscribe and give me lots of nice stars and reviews on iTunes. Can also be found on your streaming platform of choice, including Spotify, Google Play, and hope you'll be back next week. Blah, 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 blah.